Blue Face Podcast. My name is Robbie Engel, and I'll be your guide as we have conversations about what we can learn from what's going on in our lives. Most of us get stuck, and we end up wondering, is this really all there is to it? Here at True Face, we wrestle with the question, what if God isn't who you think he is and neither are you? And our resources at trueface.org hopefully are helping you live into your true identity. The conversation today with Benjamin Wendell is going to help you do that. Whether you're watching this on YouTube or wherever you're watching your podcast, like it, share it, subscribe it, and this one's going to be fun. So, Benjamin, it is good to have you on the True Face Podcast. Welcome, man. How are you?
I'm doing great, Robbie. It's a real joy to be with you.
So, your beautiful accents indicates that you're from Australia, but you're actually in California right now. The family is now, what do you call yourself in California?
Yeah.
California?
I don't know if I'm going to call myself a Californian. I'm an Australian. But yes, born and raised in Australia, which is also the heavenly language. This is the accent we all have.
I thought it was Scottish. But I might have been wrong.
It's definitely not Scottish, man.
In Australia, do you know you have, like, it's just assumed, like, you know you have a cooler accent than other people. Is that just like a universal assumption?
There is a variety of Australian accents, and you've got to do a trip down under to experience that. So there is a spectrum of Australian accents, and some are more humorous than others. Some you would struggle to understand what they're saying.
Yeah.
You know, the slang is so thick. So
That's awesome.
Yeah,
now, it's a lot of fun. You're a speaker, an author. You've been a pastor for over 20 years. You've been in ministry. You're a preacher's kid, right? That's awesome. And we can maybe process that. And a lot of your writing, teaching is content for Gen Z and millennials, which is what attracted me to you originally. And I got some thoughts on that. But you've been married to, is it Cindy, for 20 years? Three sons.
Correct,
you've
yes.
got all kinds of education, MBA from Daikin University, Stanford, MIT, School of Management, and you've got a new book, which I'm super excited about, called Good Catastrophe. And it's a blueprint for finding your way out of pain. It's not a typical book. It's more of a no-hold-barred message on redemptive hope that will breathe new sunshine into your soul, which I love. And that title is pretty strong, man. I saw that and reached out to you because I said, I want to learn more about this. I heard the book's coming up, and it's launching in like a week. When this airs, it launches on April 18th, Good Catastrophe, Benjamin Wendell. But how'd you come up with the name on that? That's a strong name.
Well, the name is actually, there is a story behind the name, and thank you for the kind introduction. I went on a search, Robbie, for a word that captured a dual meaning, which was this, that good comes out of difficulty and challenges. And literally, I couldn't find an English word that where a single word means both of those things. And I looked in, I mean, my heritage is Greek. I looked Greek, Spanish. I mean, I'm looking through different languages. But I came across a word from J.R.R. Tolkien called catastrophe. Yes. Catastrophe. Now, let me spell that for you. E-U, catastrophe. That prefix, E-U, literally means good catastrophe. So in Tolkien's writings, you know, Lord of the Rings, Hobbit, and so forth, you'll actually see this theme. And if you've watched the movies, you'll be able to think and go, oh, I saw that. He had this concept that when things looked the bleakest, when people were at their lowest, it was at that point where there was a turn towards the good. And he put that into a word, a single word. you catastrophe. I love the tension of that because for me, it articulated what I'm trying to describe within this book, that pain and hardship and challenges are not our enemies. They're not things that we should eliminate or even can eliminate, but in fact, God uses the challenges and the difficulties in our life to truly make us who we are.
I saw that you're coming out with a book, and so I started doing the rabbit trail of learning about you because we do not have a relationship. This is the first time I've had a guest on the True Face podcast, Benjamin, that like, I don't know, we're not, yes. We don't go back. I don't know as well or deeply. And so this is a risk. If this is terrible, you're probably not going to, we're just not going to air it. But if you're listening to this, that means this guy's really, because I started doing the rabbit trail of some of your teaching and who you are. And I just became a fan pretty quickly in your reframe with optimism and hope out of this good news of the gospel. Particularly, you've spent a lot of time speaking and thinking about millennials and Gen Z and how the church can change. And you've been a pastor in Australia, which is so so helpful for me and us in the West, because a lot of guys like you or John Mark Comer or Tim Keller, it feels like you're prophetic, because you're speaking to a reality that feels right around the corner with such clarity. But it's just because Comer's in Portland, Keller's in New York City, and you're in Australia. You're like a decade ahead of where we are. And so your insights into the church, how we can lead for the next generation. I did a binge on some of your old podcasts and some of your writings, and I'm like, this guy gets it, and your insight and passion for that. Can you, before we get into Good Catastrophe, tell us about like what can we learn as in the Western Church of the U.S. say from what you're seeing and the correlations of what you're seeing and noticing after being a pastor in Australia, which feels like, and you might correct me, how far ahead of you, and are we on the path to learning from you and being like you?
Yeah. Interestingly, I also pastored in Portland, Oregon for a number of years. So moved from Portland back to Australia and pastored there. And yes, Australia is a highly secularized society. So I think, yes, there are degrees of your context shapes your message. And when you're wrestling with things as a pastor, it forms things within you. But I think in the West in general, like in the last 6 to 12 months, it has reached a tipping point where we've had that collective light bulb moment to go, oh, things have just changed and they're not going back. And I think that raises a lot of questions for those of us that are passionate about things like the local church and Christian ministry. But for me, it's more personal even than just my journey as a pastor. I'm a millennial myself. I was raised in it. I'm a pastor's kid. I've been around it my entire life. So, you know, for me, when I read that 2/3 of kids that are raised in the church walk away from the church, I'm like, well, that's my family. You know, that's my siblings. That's my Christian school I was raised in. That's my youth group. It's my observation that those numbers are very real. And that certainly has become a passion of mine, because Robbie, for me, if I was to condense down just one thought for you on this, it's this, that our challenge and our enemy is not that culture out there is changing so much. And we're very good at focusing on that as Christians, like, oh my goodness, look at what's happening in the world. Most people are not, young people are not walking away from church because of what's happening out there. They're reacting to church culture. They're reacting to a leadership style that they've been raised in. And so a lot of it is internal. So I address it from both of those approaches that, hey, on one hand, I'm a millennial. I'm speaking to my own culture, my own generation. And then secondly, as a pastor, hey, there are a lot of things that we can do internally to bring about generational renewal and bring about change within the church.
That's way harder to do. It's easier to judge the changes in the culture, Benjamin. Much easier than going, what needs to change in me and the leadership in my church and how I can be a part of that. So you said you know, the light bulb has led to us needing to ask some real questions. And I'm assuming that the primary question is, what is the culture that I'm a part of and influencing that needs to change? Is that what I hear you saying? Which is the harder work of evaluating who I need to be, how I need to change.
Yeah, I mean, I think I would just, I would condense that question down just to one word, why? So if we have this mandate of the Great Commission to go and reach the world, go and reach nations, disciple nations, but our own kids raised within our own cultures and faith communities and youth ministries and church camps and conferences and revivals and all that we do, literally the ones that we've raised within our cultures are walking away at alarming rates. Why are we not at least pressing the pause button and just asking this question? Why? Why?
What do you see?
Why is it happening?
You know, unpack for us some other questions that we could be asking about that why.
Well, for me, in my journey, I've chosen to be a part of the solution. I believe there is hope for the church. I'm optimistic about the future of the church. I think God is in control. The local church is needed more now than ever. But culturally within the church, we're not gonna modernize or fix things by better stages with more LED screens and better lights and cooler social media feeds. We have to look deeper. We have to get into culture. We have to get into things like theology. We've got to look at the questions that they're asking. And it's a part of the reason why I wrote this book, Good Catastrophe, because interestingly, Robbie, when they survey young people, one of the primary theological barriers that they face to not church, just engagement with the Christian faith, is they don't know how to handle the question of why bad things happen to good people and how to process suffering. And this book isn't really an answer to why bad things happen to good people, but it is a whole new approach to how we conceptually see the challenges and imperfections in our life.
I think that one of the big gaping holes in the Western church, as a pep, this is soapbox between two new friends, is our theology of suffering. And we have spiritualized blessing as meaning no suffering, and that therefore an assumption that if bad things happen, it's not a blessing. And God's going, has this passion of yours, which I can't wait for this book, is it has the passion come more from your own experience or a story of like suffering that led to this you catastrophe, this good catastrophe in your own life? Or is it a response to watching what's happening in society as we're moving to a post-Christian society with all the trauma and not having a theology that fits that?
It started for me as a local church pastor recognizing, you start out of Bible college or whatever your Genesis story is for starting a church, which is what I did, and pretty quickly you realize that you're constantly walking with people through pain and challenges and crises. So it kind of started as that, but then, you know, it grew into, I want to address a cultural moment. There's so much global upheaval and division and strife and uncertainty about the future. I want to help people address that. But then, of course, in their own lives, anxiety, fear, depression. But then for me personally, I mean, gosh, you just look at my last year, Robbie. I lost my brother in very tragic circumstances to cancer. I lost two grandparents. I went through, you know, major life change that was difficult emotionally to process, huge transition in my life, relocated countries, cultures. I mean, just massive, you know. And I find that fascinating that it's not just one thing. It's like, oh my goodness, I don't know how many more of these layers can stack up. And if we have this postcard theology, which goes something like this, you know, God's going to favor me and prosper me. And what that means is that I'm going to have this postcard beautiful life. And what happens is life throws mud at that postcard. And we have generations that simply then don't know how to handle that. They don't know how to process it. They think something is wrong. And in my era of being raised in a church, I would just say we're really good at talking about breakthroughs and miracles and suddenlies and all of those things, but we didn't necessarily leave room or a seat at the table for suffering and adversity. And yet we know this about life, that a big part of life is how we handle adversity. But here's the deal. Theologically, it is a primary discussion of how we relate to God through the New Testament. Look at the writings of Paul. The guy was so candid and vulnerable and yet full of faith. No one can read Paul and go, you know what, the guy's just a bit of a downer. He's a pessimist. He's negative. He doesn't believe in the goodness of God. It's like, look at Romans 8. All things work together for those who love God, work together for good for those who love God. But we forget what the all things were. You have to actually read the story of the Apostle Paul. The all things that God works together for good were problems. The all things were not good things. They were bad things. And so Paul's journey taught him that God is so good that God can take the bad and orchestrate it in our life to good purposes. It doesn't mean that we're going to live a life free from adversity and challenge and hardship. And here's what I would hope to press on people, Robbie, that if we truly understood what they did in our lives, we would actually reach a point where we're no longer trying to even eliminate those things, because we recognize that hardship and hope together do something for us that a problem-free life could never do.
I love that. Hardship and hope do something when combined that a problem-free life will never do. And God loves us too much to allow that to happen, to miss out on that good life that comes with hardship and hope. So you've lived that as you're writing this book and getting prepared to launch the book. You've lived through some of that catastrophe in your own life. What's been the hardest truth to trust and to reconcile as you specialize in understanding and applying hardship and hope and this good catastrophe, and you're in the middle of it yourself? What's the most like, am I a hypocrite? I can't practice what I'm preaching. What's been the hardest part of that for you over the past year?
You know, I didn't feel that way. It didn't make me question the narrative of what I've written about. In fact, it reinforced to me, oh my goodness, if we don't have a framework on how to process this kind of thing, like when you lose, and my brother was 18 months older than me, when you go through that kind of loss, firstly, when you hear Christians say things to you that you're just like, that's, you're not helping me. You know, it would be better for you not to say anything than try to put a positive spin on this for me. I don't need that. That's a misread of grief and of challenge. So I think you go through those, and to me, it reinforced it. But I've had this moment, because my book was already written for the most part. And I'm like, I'm going through so much hardship and suffering. Maybe I shouldn't have called this book, you know, Good Catastrophe. Maybe I should have called it, you know, The Good Life or something else. Maybe this title has cursed me or something. I'm not sure. But my observation is, you know, having pastored and walked with people for long enough, you're either in the midst of a challenge right now. And again, that could be mental health. That could be loneliness. It could be isolation. It could be marriage. It could be with your children. You're right now struggling with something. Yep. Or you're about to enter into something. And for me, I did a deep dive on the story of Job. And I have come to the perspective that there are significant aspects of the life of Job that we could revisit and potentially have misread and formed some unhelpful conclusions about. And I took a lot of comfort in re-looking at the life of Job, and what I discovered
unpack some massively of those nuggets helped me to tease us into getting the book.
Yeah, well, Have you heard this way of telling the story of Job, Robbie? Because I know I sure have, being raised in the church. Job was a man who went through immense suffering, right? He was at the pinnacle of life, the good life, money, power, prestige. His life was booming. And he loses everything in a single day. Like children, business, physical health, just a catastrophic combination of tragic events that assaulted his life. The guy's physically unrecognizable. Fast forward this guy's life to the end. And it seems like the guy gets it all back. He ends with more children and more money and better business. And so the telling of the story goes something like this. If you're going through pain and challenges and have hope in God, God will give it all back to you. He'll fix the postcard. And in fact, you'll get double the blessing and double the increase and double everything. I've come to resist that telling of the story. One of the main reasons for that is, firstly, Job did not get back what he lost. Job lost 10 children. I have 3 sons. Robbie, you can't come to me one day and say, hey, I got a trade for you.
Yeah.
Like, what's the trade? You're like, you give me 3 of your children and I'll give you 6. Like, well, yeah, mathematically, if we're talking about money or trading real estate, that makes sense. But these are my children. You can't give me 3,000 other children to replace my 3 children. They're my sons. So Job did not get back what he lost. What hope enabled Job to do was to dream again and rebuild his life when he didn't get the outcome that he wanted. That's one of the misnomers about hope. Hope is not there to magically erase every challenge or problem. Hope is the force that enables you to reach into your most difficult moments, your greatest challenges, your deepest pains, and turn those things towards your greatest growth. Hope is there for those situations that knock you to your knees, fill your eyes with tears, the situations that you thought, am I ever going to be able to recover from this, live again, rebuild, laugh again. Hope takes those and redeems it towards the purposes of God, where we're able to look back, much like when I talk to my grandparents, they say this, and say, the things that nearly broke me, caused me the most hardship, are literally the things that made me who I am as a human being. That's
what
hope is.
Tell us more about what hope looks like in the middle of the struggle. Like for those of us in the middle of the suffering or a wound, hope's annoying to hear sometimes in ways that some Christians say it, which is not what you're saying. The, hey, have hope, your brother will be in heaven, and, you know, like, spin it positively. When we are in grief or in trauma or in catastrophe or suffering, or others are, how do we communicate and lean into what hope is in our own lives and for others?
What if we described all of those things as a fire? What happens when the fires hit? Tragedy, hardship, and so forth. Well, in Australia, we have a lot of eucalyptus trees. They are the prevailing species of tree. And not that long ago, there was a forest fire where I live. And afterwards, I mean, the ground was covered with, you know, just black ash, smoldering. Smoke still in the air. And you know what? It wasn't but a few months before I visited the same patch of land, and there were all these green shoots across this burnt out, charred land. So I did a study on eucalyptus trees. I'm like, oh my goodness, how was there like 1,000 new trees here, right? And I found this, that their seed capsules actually open when they're burned. And their seedlings thrive in freshly burned, ash-rich soil. So there is a species of eucalyptus trees that the coating around the seed has to be melted by fire in order for it to germinate. So here's the deal. It's not just a story of surviving fires. It's better than that. It's that the fire is necessary in order for the potential to be birthed. And I think for those of us right now that are going through a fire, it's recognizing that my mission here is not just surviving this ordeal. It's knowing that with hope, God is going to take this ordeal, and there are seeds that will only be unlocked. There are components of who I am as a human being, how God created me. There are dimensions and layers to who I am and chapters of my future that are only unlocked and germinated because of this fire. It's not that we start to enjoy the fire, but we do start to embrace some of life's challenges in a bit of a different way. And you know what that produces? It produces this magical, very special quality called resilience. And particularly younger generations are in massive need of that quality.
What else does it look like when we get this right? When we have hope in the middle of suffering and difficulty, the byproduct of that is resilience. What does that look like in our hearts, and what framework for those of us in that spot right now of trying to have hope and trying to be resilient in the middle of suffering, what framework or encouragement would you have for us in that spot?
I've come to view life's challenges like a bicycle. There are two wheels. One wheel are the good things in life, and one wheel are the bad things in life. And I used to think, you know what? I can be truly happy and filled with joy when just everything in my life is great. My family is great. My marriage is blessed. I'm of perfect health, right? Then you soon realize, oh, I may never even get a single day of my life that's problem-free. So I've got to figure out how to ride the real bicycle of life where I've always got both wheels spinning at the same time. In other words, there's always some good happening in my life, always. There's something to be grateful for. There's something to thank God for. And chances are, there's always some kind of imperfection that I'm facing in my life. So instead of delaying my happiness and gratitude and joy until that negative is removed or that problem resolves itself, what if I get on with riding the bike and recognizing every day of my life is going to be it's an alloy. It's a mixture of challenge and goodness. Both coexist, and that coexisting, and here's the key, has a symbiotic relationship. They're not actually opposite ends of the spectrum. And that's why if you just even took out a napkin, Robbie, a helpful little exercise for people, and you write out like, here are the hardest moments of my life and the biggest challenges I've gone through. And then just draw a line down and start to write, here are the greatest blessings, the greatest opportunities, the greatest joys in my life. And you know what you'll find? You will tend to find there are links between those two things. That starts to reframe how
that's
you
the symbiotic
view
relationship,
hope.
Which that bicycle analogy is really powerful for me. I got off the phone with a friend 30 minutes ago, and he said, how you doing? And I was like, I've been in a funk for like a week. I had a head cold, so I took some steroids, and it made me grumpy and irritable at every living person for like 7 days as like some byproduct to the, and I'm hearing you talk about this bicycle of the joy resting in the truce, which looks like character building and resilience in the middle of difficulty. And it was a head cold and irritability by steroids. And I felt like I needed to put my effectiveness of how I can love others on pause until it got through my system. And I gave myself permission to wait till the steroids got out of my system to be a loving human again. I'm pretty convicted right now of the lack of resilience that I've been feeling the past week, man.
Well, it's funny you mentioned that, Robbie, steroids. When I landed in Dallas from Australia, just a really long flight, right? And I put my back out. I'm at this great event. I was so looking forward to being there. I'm up in my hotel room, and my back was so bad, I'd have three paramedics lift me to turn me over, and I got steroid injections. So I'm like, on one hand, I'm here and I'm in my new chapter of life. And on the other hand, I'm also taking these steroids. And they do affect you. I'm not sure if you're a fan of the comedian Jerry Seinfeld. He wrote this about his own life. He said, if I had to trade in the experiences I've had in my life, the last ones I'd trade in would be the really bad ones. Those are the things I'd hold on to until the end, because those are the ones that harden your resolve. It's a great quote. And I think that's what Tolkien was talking about with good catastrophe, that there is a turn that takes place. I believe that's what the Apostle Paul was talking about when he talks about all things working together for good, but those all things actually being bad things. And in fact, the more I studied scripture, Robbie, I found this, that God specializes in hard situations. These are not the exceptions to the norm, but in fact, God is most active, most at work, most powerful, and most strategic when the odds are stacked against his people. And I think that should be cause for hope in all of us to recognize, if I'm going through difficulty, I can know this, God is going to be at work in those moments in such profound ways, but it may look differently to what I think or wish it would look like.
I love Yancey's book. I can't even remember the title, but he talked about, like, we sit here and want, like, oh, if we could only see or hear from God, everything would be good. And he's like, well, the Israelites had that and it wasn't so good. And the journey of redemption and love, how do you speak to the theology of, does God allow bad things? Does he redeem the things that will happen? And they, like, how do you give words to that for people?
Well, what about the Apostle Paul, who talked about this thorn in his flesh, some degree of suffering and pain? He seemed to be a pretty good follower of Jesus to me. Missionary, gave everything for the cause of Christ. So you're like, well, if God wanted to, in God's sovereignty, God could just heal him. I'm not sure we'll ever come to a place emotionally, not just intellectually, that will ever make any sense to us. If God is all powerful and God is all knowing, it's very hard to understand why there will ever be suffering. Because if God knows, God sees, and God cares, and God has the ability and the power to change something about this, why doesn't he? The only way this makes sense for followers of Christ is eternity and heaven. And we have just become so accustomed to a theology of what Solomon calls life under the sun, here and now, life on earth. So if I'm blessed now and things are good now, God's favor is shining upon me. But from a biblical point of view, we have to see life, not just life under the sun, which we know is broken and fallen and sin has entered into the human story and there is sickness and disease. We have to see the broader redemptive curve of the narrative of what's in scripture and the story of God, that eternity and heaven, to me, is the only place I've been able to find some degree of being able to reconcile that within myself. And I believe God is good. I believe God sees and God cares. But I think it will only ever make sense to us on the other side of eternity. And that especially relates to people that have been through true tragedy. They've lost children. They've lost spouses. They've gone through unthinkable things. And they're like, where was God in the midst of that? And if God actually loves me the way you're describing, and God was able to have made about a change, why didn't he? But one quick little example, Robbie, going back to Tolkien, because some of this comes full circle. He contracted a debilitating fever. November 8, 1916, he's in the trenches of World War I, catches a debilitating fever, he's going to die. He's sent back to England from the war because he has a debilitating fever. So where's God in any of that, right? Except that all of his friends that he was fighting with, his school friends on the battlefield, almost all of them died in the war. And his life was saved. His life was saved through the catastrophe that he went through of catching the fever. So I think even there, in some of the micro narratives of our lives, we don't know how God weaves some of the difficulties that we've been through and how he uses those things to be a help and a blessing to others. We wouldn't have one of the greatest literary giants of the 20th century without Tolkien contracting a fever. we don't know how God uses our life to be a blessing and help others, in terms of how he uses the hardships we've been through.
I was pretty shaped along those lines. It's like an old Chinese proverb or something. Old man has a prize horse. The villagers say, sell the horse. He says, you know, no. And then his son rides it, breaks his leg, and he goes, see, this is what happens. You should have sold it. And he goes, I'm not saying this is good or bad that my son broke his leg. His son, they draft to the army. His son doesn't go to the army, doesn't die. And he goes, see, I'm not sure if it's good or bad. The horse runs away. See, I'm not sure if that's good or bad. The horse returns with 10 other horses. See, I'm not sure if that's good or bad. You know, it's over and over of like this bicycle analogy of like, right, we are functioning through the wrong friends. And if y'all did not listen, hit the 30-second back a bunch to listen to what Benjamin just said, because that was a blessing to me of like the framework of trying to get our head around what's good, what's bad is not ours, and it's impossible for us to gauge. We have to have an eternal view of that, which we'll never have. So it distills down into, okay, God, I trust you. Regardless of if it feels good or bad, your sovereignty and your love for me, I can trust. Because with that eternal perspective, that changes the framework of our pro-con evaluation, and that's the wrong premise, which, man, you said so well, Benjamin. That's an encouragement to me. I think of, I was shaped pretty significantly by that verse where Jesus comes back, he's sitting with Peter on the beach, and they're eating, you know, they're having breakfast after Jesus raises from the dead with one of his best friends in the world, Peter. And they're talking, and he predicts Peter's death as a martyr at the end of a faithful life of Peter building the rock of which the church is built. And it's like, if I'm Peter, I'm like, hold on, Jesus, who just raised from the dead, who's my best friend. How about you take care of that one? Can you please not help me die a martyr's death after a life of faithfulness? Because that's a crappy postcard with a lot of dirt on it. And my postcard looks like a faithful life, be the rock of the church, and then die and go to heaven. And it's so hard for me to get my head around. Jesus as love loved Peter too much to not let that wheel of the bicycle happen. And it's like, from an eternal perspective, we can't contemplate that.
Right. So true. Yeah, I know. It's the eternal perspective is, I think, what gives us the context for what we're talking about here.
Your passion out of your own experience for the next generation of Gen Z and millennials, which y'all listen to some of Benjamin's old stuff. Is your white paper still out? How do we get your white paper on Gen Z's and millennials?
Yeah, just head over to Benjamin Windle, WINDLE.com, and love you to check out some of the
your thought leadership on there. How we love and honor and serve the next generation as the church has been really cool for me the past few weeks as I've done a deep dive into your stuff. And watching how you've married a sensitivity and an empathy and a love for Gen Z and millennials with this good catastrophe framework that we can apply hope in the middle of suffering, which is the bottleneck for Gen Z and millennials on how they see God. This is he fair or not? And the outcome of that being resilience, which is also an opportunity and a need for all of us in these times of change, especially the next generation. I see what you're doing.
Right.
It's all coming together, Benjamin. I love your strategic passion for the next generations and speaking truth to what I need to hear. So thanks.
Yeah, well, the CDC just came out with a report. I think it was 56% of teenage girls said they felt a constant sense of hopelessness and sadness. These numbers are just overwhelming. People are saying Gen Z, they're the hopeless generation. There's so much pessimism. They look to the world and the future, and they're not excited like we were when we were kids or teenagers. Like, I've got a dream for what the future holds. And I am stirred by that because there is a generation that desperately needs hope, but the narrative that we put around hope needs to make sense for the new world. And our old scripting around that, that just kind of, you know what, believe in God and everything about your life is, you know, kind of going to be picture perfect. We've got to present a grittier message, which is going to help them navigate a lot of complexity, a lot of cultural challenges, a lot of social needs. And that's why returning to the story of Job is so helpful, because we know this man kind of did everything right. You know, we know that in the story of Job. He kind of did everything right. And he went through the deepest form of suffering that we read about by the cross of Jesus in the scripture. So I would encourage Gen Z and millennials, hey, true hope is not hype. And if you felt like hope is actually hype and that's just a church pumping you up, no, no, no. Hope is one of the most profound, potent elements of the nature of God to work in our life. And no matter how bleak things look, hope can turn up. We talk about the trifecta of the Christian faith, hope, and love. We're good at talking about faith. We're good at talking about love. We need to start talking more about hope.
Amen. Let it be so. Benjamin, this was a ton of fun. Y'all go to BenjaminWendell.com, get his book, Good Catastrophe. And dude, we'll have to have you on here again. This was a lot of fun. Stay the course, man.